Hurrah versus Commonwealth of Virginia Department of Medical Assistance Services. Jeremy Flax, Appellants Counsel. Michelle S. Callen, Solicitor General. Samuel Towle, Deputy Attorney General. Brittany M. Jones, Deputy Solicitor General. Rodolfo R. Ramigo, Senior Assistant Attorney General. Laura S. Huerkamp, Assistant Attorney General. Laura H. Cahill, Assistant Attorney General, Appellees Counsel.
Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
I am. Thank you, Justice Goodwin. May it please the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court, my name is Jeremy Flax. I represent the appellant, Amir Farah. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
This case comes to you on appeal of the trial court's holding in a Medicaid reduction hearing. The trial court was bound by reason of the Supremacy Clause to follow United States Supreme Court law because the relevant Medicaid statutes are federal laws. Instead, the trial court specifically stated it would not follow Albhorn and Waz. In rejecting controlling Supreme Court of the United States authority and failing to determine the value of Farah's case and allocate the settlement proportionally, the trial court committed reversible error. In actuality, this is a property rights case. The trial court awarded DMAS $85,500 of its $96,000 lien, but approximately $76,000 of that amount belongs to Farah, because the Albhorn Waz cases limit DMAS's recovery to approximately $9,000. Interestingly, even DMAS makes a tacit admission in its brief on page 24 that it may have been awarded Farah settlement money, but suggests that number is $30,000, not $76,000. Prior to its ruling, Farah provided the trial court with a roadmap when he submitted proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law based on the holdings of Albhorn and Waz. This pleading can be found in the joint appendix on pages 758 through 767. Nevertheless, the trial court rejected Supreme Court of the United States case law, made no findings as to the value of Farah's case, and did not determine the portion of the tort settlement designated for medical care. The trial court allocated the settlement without articulating how or why DMAS should recover over 88% of its lien, while Farah, the horribly injured victim, would be left with only 7% of his damages. Farah adduced considerable evidence enabling the trial court to confirm the value of his injury claim, which included disfiguring and permanently disabling injuries, preventing Farah, a tax-paying U.S. citizen, from returning to any gainful employment. The only evidence of case value before the trial court was from Farah's expert, who reviewed each element of damage and valued the claim at $4 million. DMAS did not contest the opinion of Farah's expert, but instead argued the settlement amount was the true value of the case, which is simply not a credible argument. In the absence of some other reliable and reproducible method for ensuring compliance with the federal Medicaid statute, the federal Medicaid anti-lien statute, the trial court must apply the Albhorn-Waz method to determine what amount of fair settlement was representative.
Counsel, I've read those cases multiple times, and I don't see where there's this formula that you want the court to adopt is anywhere embraced by the Supreme Court. I mean, yes, there needs to be an allocation, clearly, but in terms of this method that you propose, some lower courts have employed it. A lot of lower courts have said we're not doing that, it's not required. How can you credibly say the Supreme Court requires it when nowhere in the cases do they say this is the method that must be employed? To the contrary, they say states have broad flexibility.
Justice McCullough, I think in the absence of some other reliable and reproducible method of complying with a federal anti-lien statute, you're left with the Albhorn-Waz formula. And there is a formula. In Albhorn, as we know, the allocation was 1/6. There was a determination that the settlement value was 1/6 of the true case value. And the Supreme Court very clearly held that the Arkansas Medicaid agency could not recover more than one-sixth of its payments. In my view, that is a formula, and WAS approved Alborn. Repeatedly, WAS cites with approval the Alborn allocation method. It's true.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt you in that discussion, you're right. There is a formula that has been used that appears to tighten the boundaries of equity, but our General Assembly says the formula is equity, meaning experienced trial judges who, the huge majority of them, were experienced litigators who can make these judgments very prudently based upon judicial prudence and their understanding of what's fair, which is all equity is. Why do you think this formula is mandated under the Supremacy Clause when, as Justice McCullough just pointed out, no U.S. Supreme Court case has ever said that, and they've said the opposite? But more importantly to me, even with the assertion that we need a formula, we have a formula. We have literally dozens of statutes that tell trial judges in their role as chancellors, use the principles of equity. And we all know what they are. And yes, it is not measurable, like a slide rule would measure it, but that's the observation you make the more you do this job. So what's wrong with what the General Assembly has given our trial court?
Justice Kelsey, I addressed that issue starting on page 22 of my opening brief. But to summarize, the problem is what happened in this case. The problem with using the statute that says simply follow equity as the equities appear does not provide sufficient guidance to the trial court. And where the trial court is going to ignore the authority of the United States Supreme Court.
You know, you said that a couple of times. I have to interject. Can you give me a statement by the trial court which demonstrates the trial court said, I am in open defiance with the U.S. Supreme Court and I will not apply its precedents? Because I think that's what you're trying to imply, and that seems a bit of an overstatement to me.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe on the opening of my reply brief, I repeat the important points. The trial court stated, I believe the case relied on the plaintiff. Parenthetically, I relied on two cases, Alborn and Waz. With all due respects, is distinguishable. One of those cases had a stipulation of what the value was in this case. I'm at the joint appendix on page 516. Continuing. I also, despite the language in the United States Supreme Court, can't help but conclude that applying that fraction automatically would seem to encourage settlements for undervalue with a second trial, particularly when Virginia has a code section directly on point, balancing the equities as opposed to dividing up percentages. So I just want it clear that I am not applying that standard in this case.
All right, well, you've answered my question, but I think you lose the point, because that case does not say that it's a mandated formula. So a trial judge who says, I'm not going to apply a mandated formula is defying case law. A trial judge who says, I'm not applying a formula that I could apply, but I have the discretion to apply other formulas.
Well, Justice Kelsey, had the trial court made the appropriate findings of fact required by Alborn and Waz, which is to determine a case value and to apportion the elements of FARA's damage and come up with the amount that is for medical payments made proportionally based on his settlement, which is less than 10% of his case value, we'd probably be in a different position. So had the trial court read 8.01, 66.9 in a manner that incorporated the law of Alborn and Waz, I think we would probably, well, the appellant wouldn't be here today because there would be compliance. But the problem with the statute, Justice Kelsey, is that it leaves so much of the findings and the resolution of these Medicaid reduction hearings to the whim of the trial court. There is no
Well, why should the trial court leave the decision to the whim of an expert witness? on something as amorphous as the true value of a case. You're an experienced litigator. Most of the judges on our court had years of litigation. The whole concept of the true value is incredibly intrinsically amorphous. And we're going to put a formula on it and allow experts to fill in the blanks, and that's how equity works?
I can only tell you, Justice Kelsey, that that's exactly what the Supreme Court said you must do. You must find the true value of the case. You must determine the damages suffered by the beneficiary in order to determine what amount is limited to payments for medical care. So if you have a settlement that is one-tenth of the true case value because of the fact that there's limited insurance money, then everybody takes less, not just the beneficiary. And that's been made absolutely clear by Alborn and Waz. What I'd like to do is quote regarding another important point. When you determine the amount that the Medicaid agency will recover, you must use the amount it paid as the multiplicand, not the amount of the bills, not the billed amount, but the paid amount. Because Alborn affirms a formula where the multiplicand of the amount is actually paid by Medicaid, and Waz affirms that Alborn is correct. And I would argue, period, end of argument. After determining that the payments made by Medicaid in Alborn represented one-sixth of the case value, and Justice Kelsey, that's just an example of where Alborn specifically references the phrase case value. The plaintiff in Alborn argued Medicaid could not recover more than one-sixth of its payments, not one-sixth of the amount billed by the providers, but one-sixth of its payments. Arkansas argued there was no such limit on the recovery, but the Supreme Court of the United States flatly rejected Arkansas's position and affirmed the limit on the Medicaid recovery was one-sixth of the payments made. Alborn again at page 284, this would be citing the 547 U.S. Citation, page 284, holding that the exception to the federal anti-lien statute is limited to payments for medical care. And Waz cites Alborn with approval. Waz is 568 U.S. at 634. Waz says federal law requires an assignment to the state the right to recover that portion of a settlement that represents payments for medical care. Waz repeats the same thing at page 638, reimbursement for medical payments made. So one important point where DMAS and FARA disagree is, what is the multiplicand? Is the multiplicand the amount paid by Medicaid, or is it the amount billed by the providers? And the Supreme Court in both Alborn and Waz make clear the multiplicand is the amount paid by Medicaid. So the outer limit of what Medicaid can recover, of course, is what it paid. But where FARA is taking 10% of the case value by settlement because there's no other money available, then the Supreme Court says DMAS also takes 10% of the amount paid. That's the beauty of this formula, because it's reproducible. It's reproducible across a wide range of injury cases.
Mr. Flax, this is Justice Powell. If we disagree with you that the Supreme Court precedent requires that we use the formula, where does that leave your argument?
If you disagree that the formula that I believe is embedded in Alborn and approved by Waz is not applicable, then you must come up with another reliable, reproducible formula that will not deprive the Medicaid beneficiary of his property right, or Virginia will remain in violation of the United States Supreme Court law requiring, interpreting, I should say, the federal Medicaid anti-lien statute. So whatever Virginia comes up with, it has to
articulate for me again, please, why you believe our statute does not do that. I'm not understanding.
The best example is what happened in this case. The court made no findings of fact that are required by Alborn and Waz? None whatsoever. And along the lines of valuing the case, valuing Farah's damages, and determining based on his reduced settlement, or the settlement that was just a small fraction of his true case value, what amount DMAS will recover. You can't simply run through that decision-making process and just come up with numbers that are not founded.
Where does your theory intersect with the body of law that says the court does not have to articulate its findings?
Well, Waz and Alborn make clear that the court does have to articulate the findings, Justice Powell. It's very clear. Those cases make absolutely clear that the trial courts must articulate their findings. I don't believe you can read those two cases without that conclusion.
And so you would read it to say the trial court needs to state, I'm apportioning 20% to pain and suffering, I'm apportioning 15% to future medicals, I'm apportioning 10%. So you think it has to go down the factors to be considered and actually state what amount it's apportioning to each?
Yes, I do. And 8.01.66.9 actually ends with the statement, the court shall set forth the basis for any such reduction in a written order. The problem is the guidance required by Alborn and Waz is not written into the statute. But yes, I do believe the court needs to articulate how it came up with the case value, what the case value is, evaluate the damages, and then determine what portion of that is for medical payments made by DMAS in a proportional manner.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I might, for rebuttal, please.
Counsel, you don't have any time left. You've gone over by 1 minute and 28 seconds.
I apologize. All right. I'm sorry. Thank you.
All right. Commonwealth.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Michelle Callan for the Commonwealth. This court should reject appellant's effort to discard the General Assembly's equitable approach to Medicaid lien calculations in favor of a rigid-based reduction method that in effect shifts money from Medicaid recipients into the hands of attorneys and experts. I begin with some background. As part of the federal-state partnership of the Medicaid program, federal law sets forth certain requirements of states in replenishing Medicaid funds when tortfeasors settle with Medicaid recipients. First, federal law requires that states seek reimbursement from third-party tortfeasors. Second, states may not impose liens on property of injured individuals. Aside from these requirements, however, the United States Supreme Court has emphasized that states are accorded broad latitude when allocating these funds. Virginia law sets forth an equitable approach to the allocation of funds from a tort settlement. Under Virginia Code Section 8.01.66.9, whenever any person sustains injuries and receives medical treatment paid for pursuant to the Virginia Medical Assistance Program, the Commonwealth shall have a lien for the total amount paid pursuant to such program on the claim of such injured person against the person who is alleged to have caused such injuries. Virginia law empowers a court to reduce the amount of the liens and apportion the recovery as the equities of the case may appear. As Justice Kelsey noted to my friend on the other side, Virginia trial judges are routinely entrusted to make such equitable judgments based upon judicial prudence and their understanding of what is fair. Appellant now insists that two United States Supreme Court cases, one from 2006 and one from 2013, require upending that equitable system selected by the General Assembly. The Alborn and Woes cases require no such thing. Appellant insists that these two United States Supreme Court cases preempt longstanding Virginia Medicaid reimbursement law under conflict preemption. Appellant and his amicus argue that because the United States Supreme Court accepted one ratio-based approach, this court must forego the General Assembly's equitable approach in favor of a judicially created ratio-based test. There are two fatal flaws to this argument that I would like to highlight. First, as Justice McCullough noted to my friend on the other side, The United States Supreme Court in Allborn did not endorse appellant's formula, much less mandate that formula. The parties in Allborn stipulated to all relevant numbers, so the formula was not before the United States Supreme Court. In Allborn, the parties apparently agreed to this, that this ratio reflected the amount of recovery representing compensation for past medical expenses in that case. But the United States Supreme Court's acceptance of those stipulated facts did not amount to an endorsement of the parties' method for arriving at those figures. Second, even had the United States endorsed the formula discussed in Allborn, that still would not trigger preemption. Conflict preemption requires an actual and direct conflict between the state and federal law. Nowhere does federal law actually require appellant's chosen formula. And any argument that the United States Supreme Court has held that a state may use a ratio-based reduction method is entirely different than appellant's argument here that a state must use a ratio-based reduction approach. Nowhere.
There's two things that I'd like you to help me with at some point in your argument. One is, does a court have to come up with, in the words of, I believe it was Chief Justice Roberts' dissent, that does a court have to determine what claims would have succeeded had there been a trial, what the damages would have been on the separate claims, and then reach the allocation? In other words, what we have here is a court essentially saying, this is the amount of the lien, I'm reducing it, and here's the figure. But at least there, the number of the justices thought you had to come up with a number of what would have, what the result might have been in a hypothetical trial, and then go down the line of what the damages are. Is that required?
No, Your Honor.
And the second point is the seeming harshness of the result here, because you have a catastrophic injury. I mean, this was no fender bender in a parking lot. He cannot work, horrible pain and suffering, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the end of the day, you have a figure that is fairly significant portion of the settlement. So those are the two things. If you could help me with those at some point and weave it into your argument, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly, Your Honor. So to address the second question first, Your Honor, I think it's important to keep in mind the perspective of what's happening here. Certainly when the court looks at it as a comparative ratio, that's one perspective. But the Commonwealth would ask the court to look at it from the perspective of Medicaid as a whole. What's being reimbursed here to the department is money that's paid for medical expenses. It's the portion of the settlement intended to go for the purpose of the medical care that this person has received. And so that's not part of the sum that is intended to reimburse the person, for example, for pain and suffering. And so that's something that the medical care that was received is something that's very easily quantifiable. There are bills for medical care. There's a list of the treatment that's received. And so when looking at it from that perspective, it's not just a question of so-and-so takes this percentage haircut and then the department takes another percentage haircut. And part of the reason why that matters from an equitable standpoint is the picture to the department and Medicaid as a whole. Any decrease in compensation to the department for medical services is ultimately paid for by the Commonwealth's taxpayers. And it also means that there's less in the Medicaid pool for treatment of other Medicaid recipients. And it's precisely for this reason that federal law requires the department to seek reimbursement from settlements with tortfeasors when the settlement encompasses medical care, because this ensures the solvency of the Medicaid program so the funds are available in the future to those who need them. And seeking reimbursement, even for the full amount, fairly places financial responsibility where it should be, on the tortfeasor responsible for the Medicaid recipient's injury. And so looking at it from the perspective of bills and medical services that have been rendered that's readily quantifiable, that's the basis for the Commonwealth's lien and the basis for the Commonwealth seeking to meet that full lien. Certainly the Attorney General is empowered under Virginia statutes to decrease that. And when the parties cannot reach agreement, the General Assembly has empowered courts to employ an equitable method in reducing that too. But But the bigger picture here is not a question of the Commonwealth obtaining a proportional haircut to, you know, the attorney's fees and other fees at issue, other amounts at issue in the settlement. It's a question of reimbursing this pool so that the Medicaid program can remain solvent. As to Your Honor's first question, I think it's notable that the question arises from a dissent from the United States Supreme Court, and in terms of what's binding on this court, looking at the text of Allborn, nowhere does Allborn require this sort of rigid formula-based inquiry that my friend on the other side advocates for, which is in conflict with the General Assembly's selected equitable approach. The General Assembly's equitable approach gives flexibility to trial courts to apportion the amounts and reduce the liens as equity requires. And certainly the court can look at all of those other factors that were laid out. But the question is whether the court must do so. And the Commonwealth's view is that equities do not require the court to go through that sort of rigid based process, and does not require circuit courts in Virginia to quantify some hypothetical true value to the case.
But counsel, this is Justice Kelsey, under your reasoning, tell me if I'm right about this, if the General Assembly were to amend the statute and simply adopt a true value ratio based reduction method, that would be entirely in their discretion to do that if they chose to.
That's correct, Your Honor. And some states have applied different approaches than Virginia's equitable approach. And the General Assembly can certainly look to other states. Some states have set forth presumptions that then can be rebutted in terms of the value of medical care as compared to liens. And so there's a whole menu of options. And that's consistent with what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Woes, that states have latitude in deciding how to apportion these funds. But Virginia's equitable approach, that is the law currently in Virginia, provides that latitude. And I'll note, Your Honor,
it's reasonable, counsel, to research whether or not the General Assembly has addressed proposals to do exactly what is being asked of us, which is to statutorize a ratio-based reduction model. Has that ever come up for the General Assembly and been addressed either favorably or disfavorably?
So the General Assembly has looked on numerous occasions to amend the statute, none of which have been successful. For example, 2007, 2008, 2009, most recently in 2018, House Bill, Senate Bill 159 talked about reduction of liens, and the proposal was that the lien shall be reduced by deducing the amount from the portion of the recovery representing compensation for medical costs, the pro rata share of attorney's fees, costs and expenses incurred by the injured party or the decedent. That bill passed the Senate but failed in the House. So yes,
so the judge stated then that even though obviously the General Assembly doesn't get the last word on constitutional supremacy issues, that body has chosen not to take the view that they are required by federal law to adopt this formula. Is that a fair inference?
Yes, Your Honor. And the General Assembly has on numerous occasions following Allborn considered amending that law and has chosen not to. And that's notable. I think it also bears noting, Your Honors, that and emphasizing to this court that the United States Supreme Court decisions say nothing about Virginia's equitable-based approach, and nowhere do they hold that approach is improper. To the contrary, the United States Supreme Court in Woes emphasized that states have considerable latitude to design administrative and judicial procedures to ensure prompt and fair allocations of damages. And bolstering the conclusion that there is no conflict between the General Assembly's equitable test and federal law, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal entity chosen by Congress to review state Medicaid plans, approved of the equitable method chosen by the Commonwealth's General Assembly. So the equitable approach the General Assembly selected falls comfortably within the wide latitude states have in ensuring fair allocation of damages. Appellant's arguments are really about healthcare policy and a disagreement with the process that the General Assembly has selected. It's not about the Supremacy Clause, and this court should reject appellant's invitation to override the General Assembly's equitable approach with a judicially imposed rigid formula that has no basis in the Virginia Code. We therefore ask that this court affirm. Thank you. Counsel,
may I ask a question? Auburn seems to state that a state cannot recover Medicaid expenses from a portion of a Medicaid's beneficiary settlement that is not apportioned for medical expenses. So if we just go with the 350 settlement amount and the amount that the court allotted to Medicaid, without any more, how do we know that that does not exceed the amount apportioned for Medicaid expenses?
Because the court had evidence before it in terms of the medical care that Mr. Farrar received and in details of the exact medical procedures that he received and numbers reflecting the cost of that medical care. And so because this is something that's easily quantifiable and because there was evidence in the record reflecting the amount that the Medicare, that his medical care costs, that's, and because the circuit court's decision is consistent with those numbers, there's no basis on this record to include that the circuit court abused its discretion in exercising its equity and apportioning in the way that it did. Unless the court has any additional questions, the Commonwealth asks this court to affirm.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Appellant's time is up. Thank you all both for your arguments. Have a good day.